Welcome to All Things Collected, brought to you by the Journal of Antiques and Collectibles, a special interest magazine for dealers, collectors, and enthusiasts of antique collectibles. I'm your host, Erica Lohm. Today's episode is dedicated to nature's inspiration and influence in the antique collectibles market, as seen through the stories of famous 19th century naturalist collectors. But before we get started, let's catch up on what's happening in the world of antiques and collectibles. The phased lifting of stay-at-home COVID restrictions around the country is giving antique dealers, shop owners, and antiquers reason for optimism. Open shop owners report the early return of regulars and are experiencing growing visitor traffic as the weeks go on. On the heels of shop openings will be the return of outdoor antique and collectible flea markets, and even a few small outdoor antique shows. Unfortunately, some of the bigger summer outdoor and indoor shows have been canceled, including the July Brimfield shows and many of the shows associated with New Hampshire Antique Week. Before you venture out, visit our online show calendar at journalofantiques.com for updated openings and cancellations. Speaking of Brimfield, the show will go on, only online and in partnership with Ruby Lane. The effort, spearheaded by Clea Viveridis, the new owner of Hurton's Showfield at Brimfield, looks to bring the show to Facebook and the RubyLane.com platform to keep buyers and sellers, dealers, and showgoers connected until the live events return, hopefully for September Brimfield Week. Sellers looking to participate in the Brimfield live show are encouraged to contact Clea at 781-420-3375. In other news, curators from three Smithsonian museums have begun collecting signs and other objects from Black Lives Matter protests that were held outside the White House and other places in Washington, D.C. The Smithsonian said in a statement in June that it wants to preserve items so Americans can, quote, understand the role that race has played in our complicated 400-year history, end quote. Recognizing that the tragic killing of George Floyd and others have spurred a transformative movement, the Smithsonian Institution is collecting today so that the world, in the present and future, can understand the role that race has played in U.S. history. This coalition of museums will enable Smithsonian curators to work together with activists and groups on the ground to ensure that this grassroots-led community movement and pivotal moment is accurately documented. And there are more than just magic tricks up for sale at Potter & Potter Auctions' July 25th Magic Sale, including property from the historic home of Harry and Bess Houdini. How about their bathtub? This enameled cast-iron tub was removed from the Houdini's home, located at 278 West 113th Street in New York City, and is accompanied by extensive documentation and photographs related to its provenance. This once-in-a-lifetime find, which carries an auction estimate of $8,000 to $12,000, would be a remarkable addition to a private collection or one held by a museum or a historical society specializing in the history of magic, New York City, or Houdini. Although there is no way to prove it, it is entirely possible that Houdini may have conceptualized or rehearsed parts of his escape acts in this tub. The idea of him using it to practice endurance feats or breath-holding is a tantalizing one indeed. For more information, visit potterantiques.com. For more marketplace news, sign up at journalofantiques.com to receive our free post-press update, delivered twice a month to your inbox.
Growing up in New York City, one of my favorite places to visit on cold and rainy days when you could not play in the park was the American Museum of Natural History. From the fossils to the dioramas of wildlife from around the world staged in their natural environment, I could and did sit there for hours, mesmerized by the dinosaurs, stuffed mammals, and the many other collections on display. The founding of the museum realized the dream of naturalist Dr. Albert S. Bickmore. Bickmore lobbied tirelessly for years for the establishment of a natural history museum in New York. His proposal, backed by such powerful sponsors as Theodore Roosevelt Sr., father to our 26th president, J.P. Morgan, William Blodgett, who is also a founder of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and a number of other highly profile industrialists of their day, won the support of the governor of New York, John Hoffman, who signed the bill officially creating the American Museum of Natural History on April 6, 1869. The original museum building opened its doors to the public in 1887, but public interest in the growing collections quickly prompted the need for an expansion, the first round of which was completed by the end of the 19th century. Like other natural history museums cropping up in big cities across the country, public interest, museum expansion, and funding hinged on what the museum could bring back to the city of New York and put on display. One of the most popular ways at the time for natural history museums to build their reputations and collections was to fund an expedition to someplace new and remote. Expeditions of the 19th and early 20th centuries often brought together self-taught naturalists, taxidermists, scientists, adventurists, nature photographers, and hobbyist collectors who traveled the world to parts unknown to bring back everything from small and large mammals to flora and fauna, birds, insects, and marine life. One of the most famous of these naturalist collectors was Theodore Roosevelt Jr. His safari to East Africa and expedition down the Amazon brought to American natural history museums thousands of samples of specimens and species not seen outside their natural habitat. Many of the naturalists of Roosevelt's generation were inspired by the works of such pioneers in the field of the natural sciences as John James Audubon, Charles Darwin, Alfred Russel Wallace, Henry David Thoreau, William Stimson, Spencer Fullerton Baird, and Louis Agassiz. These men, as well as countless other avid natural collectors and observationalists of everything from insects and butterflies to birds and mammals, inspired a generation of naturalists who can be credited with the popularity and scientific study of living things as a natural science. One of the earliest natural history museums in America was put together by Charles Wilson Peale. Peale had served with George Washington at Trenton, New Jersey. After the Revolution, he opened a gallery where he displayed and sold portraits of famous revolutionaries. He began to add natural history artifacts to his displays and soon decided to devote his attention to creating a natural history museum. There were few books or resources available on taxidermy during the time, so Peale mostly taught himself how to skin and stuff animals for display. Because Peale was foremost an artist, he began making elaborate displays for the taxidermy he created. The collection grew and soon was moved to Independence Hall, where the Declaration of Independence was signed. Unfortunately, Peale struggled financially and he had to sell off his collections, including a lot that went to P.T. Barnum, who went on to add these items to his oddities museums. In 1846, President Polk signed into law the Act to organize the Smithsonian Institution as an establishment for the increase and diffusion of knowledge and American identity. The United States National Museum was founded in 1846 as part of the Smithsonian. The Natural History Building of the Smithsonian opened its doors to the public on March 17, 1910, in order to provide the Smithsonian with more space for collections and research. To outfit its new museum, dedicated to natural history, display, and scientific study, the Smithsonian went on to an aggressive acquisition spree, outfitting, sponsoring, or finding funding for numerous expeditions over the next several decades that brought unique physical specimens back from the field that could be cataloged, studied, preserved, and displayed in the country's national interest. What the Smithsonian did not take seeded the collections of other natural history museums around the country. The Smithsonian's embrace of natural history lent scientific legitimacy to what had been the work of self-taught observationalists, naturalists, and while not trained scientists, these 19th and early 20th century nature collectors, many of whom did their own field work and mastered the art of preserving their specimens for study, are credited with introducing generations to the discoveries of the natural world through their collections. You can learn more about these self-taught naturalist collectors and what they collected in the July issue of the Journal of Antiques and Collectibles, found at journalofantiques.com.
Theodore Roosevelt Jr., A Naturalist Collector of Specimens, by Maxine Carter Loam, Publisher. In 1867, Theodore Roosevelt began what he called the Roosevelt Museum of Natural History. It consisted of 12 specimens that had been carefully preserved and laid out in his bedroom. He was 8 years old. A sickly child who was often confined indoors, it has been written that Teddy found joy in adventure novels and in animals. When a neighborhood vendor gave the boy a severed head off a harbor seal carcass, an animal which at the time was plentiful in New York Harbor, Roosevelt prized the gift. He later wrote in his autobiography that preserving it felt like his own small adventure.
Roosevelt's lifelong love of nature and conservation came from his parents, Theodore Roosevelt Sr., a founding member of the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, and Martha Bullock Roosevelt. His family indulged his passion for nature preservation and the dead animal collection it produced, largely because of his childhood illnesses. As Roosevelt's health improved and his body grew stronger, his fascination with the natural world brought him out into the real world and in contact with things he read about, collected, and wished to study. In particular, birds. By age 12, young Teddy was studying taxidermy with an associate of John James Audubon. In 1872, having obtained spectacles to correct his vision and a shotgun to aid in capturing specimens, Theodore traveled with his family to Egypt and Syria, where he collected numerous birds. By then, a skilled taxidermist, he skinned and mounted the birds himself. If young Roosevelt's collection methods seemed bloody and cruel, he merely followed the accepted practices of the leading naturalists of the time. Killing was the only way to make extremely accurate observations about the physical characteristics of unfamiliar animals. While written in a childish hand, the notebooks in which young Roosevelt logged his studies reflect the zeal with which he pursued nature. They contained complete descriptions of the animals collected, including size, sex, place, and date collected, habits, and even stomach contents. In Vienna, where the family traveled after leaving Egypt, Roosevelt turned his hotel room into a virtual zoological laboratory, much to the dismay of the cousin who shared his lodgings. When he set his sights on attending Harvard University, it was largely because the legacy of naturalist Louis Agassiz, who left behind the Museum of Comparative Zoology and a detailed system of animal classifications still in use today. At Harvard, Roosevelt published his first ornithological work, The Summer Birds of the Adirondacks in Franklin County, New York. Teddy had a particular fascination with birds. Suffering from nearsightedness as a child, he had a catalog of their music in his head. He also developed strong public opinions about invasive species. During an argument known as the Sparrow Wars, Roosevelt made the case that the invasive English sparrow should be exterminated in America. His 49-page response paper to the Natural History III examination at Harvard in his senior year showed that he was a knowledgeable, prolific writer on the subject of birds and mammals and had a promising career in the natural sciences. But instead, Roosevelt chose a career in politics. However, he never abandoned his love of nature and sense of adventure, passions he pursued both during and after his presidency. As any collector will tell you, the thrill of the hunt can be as exciting as the acquisition itself. That was certainly the case when it came to Theodore Roosevelt. His larger-than-life adventures for the Smithsonian Institution on expeditions to collect specimens and species, everything from flora to fauna to birds, small and large mammals, insects, and sea life from remote parts of the world are the stories on which legends are made. Smithsonian, Roosevelt African Expedition. In 1909, shortly after the end of his presidency, Roosevelt and his son Kermit, who served as the photographer for the adventure, embarked on a 10-month African safari, officially known as the Smithsonian Roosevelt African Expedition. Billed as a conservation mission, this massive safari was financed by Andrew Carnegie and by Roosevelt's own proposed writings and outfitted by the Smithsonian, looking to collect specimens for its new Natural History Museum, now known as the National Museum of Natural History. He engaged the Smithsonian in this grand adventure by proposing the following, quote, "As you know, I am not in the least a game butcher. I like to do a certain amount of hunting, but my real and main interest is the interest of a faunal naturalist. Now, it seems to me that this opens up the best chance for the National Museum to get a fine collection, not only of the big game beasts, but of the smaller animals and birds of Africa. And looking at it dispassionately, it seems to me that the chance ought not to be neglected," end quote. The unstated but recognized value added in this arrangement was the chance for the Smithsonian to acquire specimens that had been shot by Theodore Roosevelt, President of the United States. The Smithsonian, through anonymous private donations, also funded three naturalists to join the expedition in return for the receipt of live and preserved specimens. Edgar Alexander Mearns was selected as head naturalist and bird collector. Edmund Heller was to care for the large animals, and John Alden Loring was to have charge of the small mammal collecting. The party left New York on March 23, 1909, and sailed for British East Africa. The group, led by the legendary hunter-tracker R.J. Cunningham, started out in Mombasa, British East Africa, now Kenya, traveled to the Belgian Congo, now the Dominican Republic of the Congo, and then followed the Nile to Khartoum in modern Sudan. For some of this journey, Roosevelt was accompanied by famed British bird and animal photographer Cherry Kearton, who shot wildlife and native scenes with a hand-cranked motion picture camera, later made into a movie. The expedition conducted the same of science, collected around 11,400 animal specimens, which took Smithsonian naturalists 8 years to catalog. According to Roosevelt's own tally, that figure included about 4,000 birds, 2,000 reptiles and amphibians, 500 fish, and 4,897 mammals. Other sources put this figure at about 5,103. Add to this marine, land, and freshwater shells, crabs, beetles, and other invertebrates, not to mention several thousand plants, and the number of natural history specimens totaled 23,151. Of that number, the National Museum of Natural History acquired approximately 1,000 skins of large animals, 4,000 of small animals, and other specimens totaling approximately 11,400 items. About 10,000 plant specimens were also obtained, as well as a small collection of ethnological objects. The balance went to the American Museum of Natural History in New York and the San Francisco Museum. Roosevelt and his son were personally credited with killing 512 of the animals collected, including lions, leopards, cheetahs, hyenas, elephants, buffalo, and the now very rare black rhino and white rhinos. In his 1910 book, African Game Trails, an account of the African wanderings of an American hunter-naturalist, Roosevelt provided a complete list of their kills. He justified them by saying, quote, "Kermit and I kept about a dozen trophies for ourselves. Otherwise, we shot nothing that was not used either as a museum specimen or for meat," end quote. The natural paradox. Roosevelt believed, quote, "all hunters should be nature lovers," end quote, and hunting and preserving big game animals held long-term value for humanity's study of life on Earth. In his mind, quote, "fair," unquote, hunting meant knowing natural history, knowing the land and animals, and never slaughtering for the sake of the kill alone, but for the advancement of human knowledge. He condemned, quote, "game butchery as objectionable as any form of wanton cruelty and barbarity," end quote. Although he does note that, quote, "to protest against all hunting of game is a sign of softness of the head, not the soundness of the heart," end quote. And as a pioneer of wilderness conservation in the U.S., he fully supported the British government's attempt at that time to set aside wilderness areas as game reserves, some of the first on the African continent. Known as a naturalist and conservationist, this duality, Roosevelt's love of nature juxtaposed with his passion for killing it, is perhaps the most misunderstood part of his legacy. So how does one reconcile Roosevelt's lifelong prolific shooting of wildlife with his record as America's foremost conservationist? Mark Twain, for one, could not. He regarded Roosevelt as a hypocrite. The Great Amazon Expedition. Following a disappointing loss in the 1912 presidential election, Roosevelt struck out again on a scientific adventure, this time heading for South America to navigate an unmapped river in the Amazon, an adventure he described as his, quote, last chance to be a boy, unquote. He envisioned it as part holiday and part scientific endeavor, and again secured sponsorship from the Smithsonian and the American Museum of Natural History to record and collect animal specimens on what was named the Roosevelt Rondon Scientific Expedition. The team consisted of Roosevelt, his 23-year-old son Kermit, two naturalists, including the famed American George Kruk Cherry, a team of porters, and Brazil's most famous explorer, Candido Rondon. Although not their original intended route down the Amazon, once in South America, Roosevelt set his sights instead on traversing a mysterious Rio da Dúvida, River of Doubt, a wild and winding waterway that had yet to be charted by Europeans. His friends and family expressed concern for his health and safety with his choice of the Rio da Dúvida, to which Roosevelt replied, quote, I have already lived and enjoyed as much of life as any 9 other men I know. I have had my full share, and if it is necessary for me to leave my bones in South America, I am quite prepared to do so, end quote. Cherry, a seasoned adventurer, had taken dozens of trips to Central and South America, collecting specimens for major museums. On his expedition with Roosevelt, he kept a meticulous diary, today housed in the American Museum of Natural History. It gives a day-by-day account of the daily struggles the improperly outfitted and ill-prepared expedition party faced during their 1,000-mile journey down the River of Doubt. Many in their traveling party perished along the way. Roosevelt himself was lucky to have survived after he sliced his leg open on a rock and the wound became infected. Of the 19 men who went on the expedition, 16 returned. One died by accidental drowning in rapids, with his body never recovered. One died by murder and was buried at the scene, and the murderer was left behind in the jungle, presumably swiftly perishing there. Cherry and a greatly weakened Roosevelt made it home to a hero's welcome in New York Harbor in May of 1914, with 3,000 specimens collected along the way, introducing new species never before seen outside of the Amazon, and once again making a scientific contribution to the Natural Sciences and Natural History Museums. While Roosevelt would remember his time on the Amazon as one of his greatest adventures, it was also his last. His time in the jungle had taken its toll, and for the rest of his days, he was plagued by a collection of ailments he called his, quote, old Brazilian trouble, end quote. The vulnerable bull moose stayed active and even attempted to volunteer for World War I, but he finally died in his sleep in 1919 at the age of 60. Legacy. Theodore Roosevelt is remembered as many things: American statesman, politician, conservationist, naturalist, writer, cowboy, adventurer, and of course the 26th President of the United States. As president, Roosevelt set aside more federal land for national parks and nature preserves than all of his predecessors combined. He established the United States Forest Service, signed into law the creation of 5 national parks, and signed the year 1906 Antiquities Act, under which he proclaimed 18 new national monuments. As a lifelong naturalist, Roosevelt's expectations to remote parts of the world and what he collected and recorded along the way introduced specimens and species never before seen outside of their native countries. These items were cataloged and studied by scientists across the natural science disciplines and put on display to the awe and fascination of visitors flocking to the new public natural history museums cropping up in cities across the country in the early part of the 20th century. His contributions in this manner helped advance our understanding of the natural sciences, while his stories and love of nature and adventure continue to fascinate and inspire future generations of naturalist collectors.
And we're back, sharing the latest gavel down prices on some of the most interesting items coming to market. A rare movie poster for the 1933 classic film The Invisible Man sold for $182,400 at an auction held March 21st by Heritage Auctions in Dallas, Texas. The sale coincided with the 2020 remake, starring Elizabeth Moss, which became among Hollywood's first films to go the route of video on demand. H.G. Wells' concept for a crazed scientist turned invisible is holding well with today's viewers. The poster for the famous Universal monster movie is one of only a few known to exist. The price includes the buyer's premium. For all the computer geeks out there that hate to throw anything away, a fully functional Apple I computer, conceived by Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak as a basic circuit board to be sold as a kit and completed by electronics hobbyists, sold for $458,711 in an online auction that began March 5th and ended March 12th by RR Auctions, based in Boston, Mass. Paul McCartney's handwritten lyrics to the Beatles song Hey Jude, used at Trident Studios in London in 1968, sold for $910,000 at an all-Beatles auction on April 10th by Julian's Auctions in Los Angeles. Speaking of the Beatles, a rare 1966 concert poster from the Beatles' performance at Shea Stadium in New York sold for $137,500 at an entertainment auction held April 4th by Heritage Auctions in Dallas, Texas. The guitar Kurt Cobain played during Nirvana's legendary 1993 MTV Unplugged session, a 1959 Martin D18E, sold for $6 million in June at Julian's Auctions, breaking the record for the most expensive guitar ever sold. The record was previously held by a black Stratocaster belonging to Pink Floyd's Dave Gilmour, which sold for $3.95 million last year. The victorious bidder was Peter Friedman, founder of Rode Microphones, who was present at the event. Included with the guitar is its original case, adorned with a flyer for Poison Idea's 1990 album Feel the Darkness, along with a half-used package of Martin guitar strings, three picks, and a suede bag containing a silver spoon, fork, and knife. To view the entire July issue of Inspired by Nature, visit journalofantiques.com, where you will also find past issues, other articles of interest, a calendar of upcoming shows and auctions, antique shops to visit around the country, and the value of what is recently sold at auction. While there, you can also subscribe to receive our publication in print and sign up to receive our bi-monthly free e-newsletter, Post Press Update. The Journal of Antiques and Collectibles is published by Weathervane Enterprises, Inc. Thank you.